Thank you, Judith. It's nice to get to know you. And I'm pleased to see so many people that I know, and networks are great. When I was a student, I didn't even know that science was a social activity. And one of the best things about it are annual meetings where you see people occasionally and you see them over time. So by many, many colleagues, I mean exactly that. I want to talk about two topics, and I want to relate them, and that is soil as a clay factory, which is not my own or our own moniker, but the other is soil production paradigm, soil production. So let's get going. A word about the so-called clay factory. I had the great privilege of opening 10 backhoe pits all at once on different landforms with a marvelous cast of characters from many different disciplines. And it occurred to us in the middle of it, this is in the southeast U.S., all of them are ultisols, have a clay-rich B horizon, as is shown on the right there. It occurred to us, soil is a clay factory, and I'd heard that a long time ago, and I really wanted to figure this out. And it's through the production idea that Gilbert has given us that we can look at the clay factory, I think, in a different way. These are not rare soils. If you just add up all the alfasols and ultisols around the world, that's pretty much 20% of the surface, and there are a lot of clay-rich B horizons or clay-enriched B horizons that do not make the taxonomic grade for alfasols and ultisols. So about a quarter, that's a large fraction of the Earth's surface. We can abbreviate them coarse over fine, as it's been done in the literature, coarse surface over fine subsoil. Most of the discussion, not to contradict that discussion, but most of the discussion revolves around eluviation, illuviation, what I think the French call lessivage. So what I want to do today is think about this process in the context of what will come to be, we'll see, as soil production. So here in the southeast, this is a fine ultisol, a very nice BT horizon, so it's an argillic of note. And this is a fully weathered saprolitic system there, almost 20 meters deep. And right at the very top is where the clay size, that's very important for this talk, the clay size fraction is. It's the skin of the earth. But it's not really the epidermis because it's in the subsoil. And I just rattled off on the right there. It's a soil weathering profile, we'll call it. From a residual udalt. It's currently a humid climate in the southeast, of course. It's derived from granite or granitic gneiss in the Piedmont. What a boring place. Yeah, most people in this... very good, Aaron. Most people think the Piedmont is a very boring place. It is the most exciting place to work, I will promise you. In any event, right after World War II, when the Calhoun Experimental Forest got set up, it got named after John C. Calhoun. We'll see if that name lasts. We call ourselves the Calzones, but in any event. So that's a word about one of these two topics, the clay factory or the mobilization and accumulation of clay in the subsoil. The other idea I want to relate to the argillic horizon is this soil production paradigm. Here is one of the most prominent geologists in the 19th century, and that's saying a lot. You're talking about Charles Lyell, you're talking about a whole raft of characters. And it struck me only 5 years ago. I kept hearing Gilbert this, Gilbert this, Gilbert that, Gilbert Club. I had no idea what they were talking about. And I have been educated largely through pedology. This guy is almost forgotten in terms of what has come to be known as soil production function. And there's some beautiful pictures of him in the West and a really nice biography by Stephen Pine. He subtitles it, A Great Engine of Research. And that kind of hints at the power of a lot of his writing. And here's the particular sentence that I love the best. It was written in 1877. He was John Wesley Powell put him in charge of surveying one of the last little mountain ranges that hadn't been geologically surveyed. That was the Henry Mountains in Utah. And in that booklet, he says, he realizes he's not just thinking about the Henry Mountains at this point. He's thinking about the whole Earth. Over nearly the whole of the Earth's surface, there is a soil. And wherever this exists, we know, we can be confident that conditions are more favorable to weathering than to transportation. And then he goes on to explain what he means by weathering and transportation. So what he's saying is he's thinking about the tropics to the tundra, humid zones to deserts. Most of the places on Earth have soil. Even on highly erodible or high erosion sites, there's maybe a thin soil, but there is a soil. So it was as if he thought about, that's a fundamental attribute of our planet, and what a great thing. And what is very interesting from a scientific history point of view is, for one reason or another, his work was not picked up on, particularly in pedology. And here he was talking about soil production. Gilbert's work went largely uncirculated, well over 100 years, and by the 60s and 70s, you would see it in a textbook or two, and then finally, the geomorphologist just picked it up in the 90s, and one of the papers that is highly cited now is Heimsath and company, and they really are in a pursuit. It's almost as if they're in a mathematical pursuit of the soil production function. And what I'd like to do is observe that burgeoning literature, largely still among geomorphologists, but not entirely in their domain. But think about it in a bigger idea, a sense of the idea of this system. And a marvelous paper has been written that has formally brought soil production function, soil production ideas of Gilbert into the pedological literature. And if you don't know anything about this topic, you have to read this paper. The late, great Jeff Humphreys wrote a masterpiece here, A Brief History and Its Rediscovery. And here it is, simple and elegant, so simple and elegant. So I have a weathering profile there. And basically it's an exaggerated profile because we're talking about, we made this conceptual model for the Calhoun in the Piedmont. But basically, we have weathering and transportation. So weathering means the release of little particles or big particles as the weathering advance proceeds downward into the bedrock. Then the transportation losses on a net basis are the net erosion, net drainage. And as a result, if weathering exceeds transportation on a net basis, and that's important, on a net basis over the lifespan of this weathering profile, we have a soil. And of course, open from the top, we've got to talk about atmospheric deposition for sure. But in any event, that's simple and elegant. So he talked about soil as the product of the biogeochemical weathering. 1877, you know, Dukashyev was still doing his work and he hadn't published the great book on the Chernozem. Hilgard had written the thing in Mississippi by 1860, but that was pretty early on in terms of professional pedology. He calls it soil. Merrill gave us our word that we usually use today, regolith, and defines the regolith as the unconsolidated weathering material. And that's how Gilbert was using it as soil. And in this talk and in other papers, we like to use soil, following Gilbert, I guess. In any event, it's important. The net is an important thing here, net. Net weathering exceeds transportation. Okay, let's dive into the study site a little bit, and this is the southern Piedmont. It stretches from New Jersey to central Alabama. Coastal plains on the east and the Appalachian Highlands on the right. Two easily generalizable things you can say about the Piedmont is it's about half granite, 50% granitic gneiss. And overall, if you look at the soil mapping units, you can say that there's about 90% upland or hill slope soils mapped and 10% alluvial plains. In any event, whenever you see a paper, it's often written, the rolling Piedmont. How exciting. Well, it is very exciting. I think you'll see why in a few minutes. This is just a quick plug for quarries. If you do this kind of work, please take advantage of your local quarries. There are thousands of them going 24/7 in nearly every state of the union, and they are great laboratories. Yes, they can't serve all our purposes. There's, you know, dust is in there to contaminate, but boy, you can use them. And just tell the operator you're a geologist. They'll love you. They'll welcome you. In any event, yeah. But what we did was we drilled a well. And so we, at the Calhoun, we bored our deep well is 70 meters deep. 15 centimeters diameter, so we can lower different instruments down it with relative ease. There's 38 meters deep of soil, saprolite, and weathered fractured granite before you finally hit the unweathered protolith. 38 meters of Gilbert soil has accumulated, or is accumulating, you say. The saprolite, so to be technical and careful about it, the saprolite plus soil, that part of the regolith, that soil, is 18 meters, we interpret today. In any event, Alan Bacon and I drilled 30 meters into the protolith so we could get a good sample of the unweathered material that had apparently produced the saprolite in the soil above. And Alan estimated in a 2012 paper in geology through cosmogenic beryllium 10 a minimum residence time of 2 million years. Weathering fronts that extend 12 to 40 meters. The first plagioclase weathering, we think, is at 38 meters. The pH is 4 in calcium chloride, dilute calcium chloride, till 12 meters before pH starts to creep up. We've collaborated with a Wyoming group of geophysicists who are just some of the most enthusiastic scientists I know. And to prove that, they drove across the country from Wyoming to South Carolina in February with all their equipment in it so that they could use the well and do some downhole work. But on the first trip, they did seismic velocity work, which means you extend wires across the landscape and everybody stands still. One guy gets a sledgehammer, and they proceed 3 meters at a time across the landscape to propagate waves and to measure the rate at which waves are propagated through either the unconsolidated or the fractured bedrock, or finally into the protolith. And we can compare, and we have compared what the well shows us directly against that kind of physical way of looking at the weathering front. So on the left, you can see a tau diagram of calcium, largely from calcium in plagioclase, and it's minus 1. 100% of the calcium is gone, down to 10, 12 meters. Extreme weathering, first by any measure. So here we have the weathering profile a little bit more as a physical structure in a paper that's submitted in pretty far along in review. And let's see what we can see here. I'll speak loudly.
But here's the conceptual diagram again of the soil weathering profile. Fractured bedrock down here. This is the scale, these are the meters. And one nice thing is the black line is fracture density in terms measured by lowering an instrument down the well. And that correlates with the colorized imagery that tells us a little bit about iron oxide formation. You can see those bumps line up rather well. And it's basically a pretty simple transfer of a color photo that was made and unfolded from the 360-degree televiewer. And we can kind of demonstrate that there's a correlation there between what the seismic instruments are telling us and the color X. In any event, those fractures become almost non-existent in what we see as the protolith. The most exciting thing here is in the blue line, though, and that's porosity. And we can take, there's an instrument now, it's an NMR instrument that detects water, of course, but below, what was it, 5 meters, it was saturated at this time, and we're looking at water, but basically that's, it's saturated, so it's the hydrogen in the pores. It's a measure of porosity, and so you can see where this
rock is initially opening up with pores is across the 20 to 10 meter weathering front. We could call that the porosity front, so to speak, and that's almost precisely where the plagioclase is weathered to complete dissolution. So other things that we've been able to play with, thanks to the geophysicists, are instruments that can then be taken across hills and dales. And so I want to look at the two of the big processes that are kind of initiating or contributing to weathering. And one would have to be some of the physical processes. And so I've learned all about regional rock stress. I had no idea. So regional rock stress in dimensions and in potential can be estimated. And here's a paper in which, based on the seismic velocity, here the same color scheme as before, so red and dark orange are the saprolites. Our geophysicists have interpreted these diagrams to say that the preconditioning of the bedrock, the initial fracturing of the bedrock that's physically driven by the stresses on the granite, are both regional but also topographic. There's topographic imprinting over this 2 million year time frame that is on a small scale, on a landscape scale, I should say, hundreds of meters scale, influencing the weathering front. And so what's amazing here is this bow tie feature, which is quite contrary to many textbooks. The deepest weathering has proceeded underneath the interflues, let's say, and the shallowest weathering, or the shallowest to intact, competent bedrock is underneath the drainages. How strange is that? And that's been demonstrated at several other locations as well. It's caused lots of interesting contrasts. So there's a physical force that's preconditioning the bedrock, allowing fractures to develop, allowing water that has now, we'll see here, carbonic acid, to be able to penetrate those deepest parts of the soil, of the critical zone. So let's talk about the biology of this, at least the biology as affected by the CO2. And so we can call this soil metabolism's product, one of the products of soil metabolism, of ecosystem metabolism, of critical zone metabolism. But to date, when we think,
if you look at the literature about ecosystem metabolism and we look at it in terms of the carbon cycle, we're basically looking at the cycle between the atmosphere, the plants, photosynthesis, of course, and then the respiration from above ground biomass and roots below ground. And basically, it's a cycle between the upper soil, the plants, and the atmosphere. And the question here is, what if just some small fraction, some to date unknown fraction of CO2 is actually part of this deeper weathering system? And so here's a four-year diagram that Dan Markowitz largely put together in the mid-90s, where we looked at with pretty primitive instrumentation but accurate results. You can see the seasonality, the beautiful fingerprints of different kinds of seasons. For example, here's a winter time that January there, a winter time in which the CO2 is really flushed out. Other winters in this warm temperate zone, subtropical South Carolina, where respiration apparently continues through the winter. But in any event, there's this weathering pulse that's as beautiful in terms of cycles as the litter fall. So if we take that old data and anticipate Zach Dreckheisen's paper to come, in which he's been able to do this with very much more sophisticated instrumentation. But if you take this data and just look at the means and the max and the min through the upper 6 meters, you think about the soil horizons here. Here's the carbonic acid cycle, and the potency of it is pushed to an extreme in the sea horizon. I love that. This is a pentagenic process in which the maximal, you know, force of this chemical reaction that's contributing to acidity is in the saprolite. It's not up here in the A and B horizon. That's where most of the CO2 returns to the atmosphere. But the longer time residence time gases accumulate below ground, deep in the saprolite, and the question is, what's below that? What's going on below that?
What's going on below 6 meters? And so we can say, well, most CO2 returns to the atmosphere and is part of this upper soil plant atmospheric cycle. The consumption of oxygen at depth
may be ensuring another diffusion front that keeps the CO2 diffusing downward.
And that's a bit of an ideal system because water is in the system, you know, storms push and haul through the macropores of the saprolite. But even still, if there is a CO2 to alkalinity system going on, the CO2 is being consumed at depth, and perhaps in these
long residence time gas phases, you know, some few percent of the CO2 is not returning to the atmosphere, but is basically involved in the weathering attack at depth. And here, so if that's the case, then soil metabolism clearly extends the depth of the soil to the base of the critical zone, even in this extreme environment with 18 meters of saprolite.
And we've, in a really exciting data set, Alex Cherkinsky at UGA has taken some of the gas at depth, and in six
stands where we have augured down to 5 meters and regularly collect gas these days with one very deep sample,
we're struck by the fact that the biota, the vegetative biota, is intimately connected, directly connected to the gases at great depth. And to us, to me, it unites the biota at the surface with the deep critical zone where the weathering occurs. So wrapping up here, and let's bring both of these things together, because we're headed to the argillic horizon in the end, but also the soil production system. This production system of, say, 60 meters in this diagram is composed in a sense of
rivers of decomposing feldspars. First, the plagioclase, remember I said the plagioclase disappears by about 10 meters, and then after that, the orthoclase is weathered almost to completion, leaving behind the aluminum silicate kaolinite, and this is based on a total L metals that Alan did, and then Virginia and Sue at Penn State used a variety of optical and elemental analysis of the plagioclase to estimate this through a geochemical model. In any event, these are, you know, the trace elements of biotite and muscovite are very important to this soil production treadmill, so to speak. But the major rivers are the two feldspars there. So that's the Cray factory. So let me end on a paradox, on an enigma, and it has to do with how we're using the word clay. Go back to one of our first things we learn about in soil science. What does a clay mean? What do you mean by clay? So one of the most remarkable things, however, is the depth distribution of the particle sizes, in which if you look at the less than 2 micron fraction all the way up through the saprolite, up into the lower part of the B horizon, there's 5% clay fraction. All of that kaolinite is silt and fine sand. And it's only in the B horizon that the clay size fraction exceeds 50%. And at that point,
the mineralogy of that soil horizon is 80% kaolinite as a mineral.
50% is clay size. So is granite a quartz system, a sandy system, or is it a clay factory, a kaolinitic system? And so what we're doing now is continuing to work with Alan, and he uses not just the standard pipette method, but the particle size analyzer, and I know some of you in here have one of these, Craig Rasmussen, I think your group does. This is going to take us into, let's quibble about the fine points here, but this is a huge step. Now we have distributions of particle sizes, and we have a hypothesis of what's happening here that's shown by the arrows, but we think we're losing
the hypothesis is these losses of the medium and fine sand, and even the finest of sands, are the weatherable feldspars or the kaolinites also, and then they're being gained in the finer size fraction. And then the bioturbation is mixing the top, but the eluviation and illuviation, very important for this soil production system, accumulates the coarse and the fine clays
in the BT. And I think this is the last slide. Unless you think this is a story about Calhoun, and if you remember at the very beginning, 25% of the Earth's surface was coarse over fine textured soils, I think perhaps we have something like this going on. We have many coarse over fine over coarse, and there's a pedagogic process that I don't think is really well, let me put it out there, is not really well understood that's going on at the top of the saprolite and the bottom of the B horizon. So you can go in the Piedmont on diabase, on phyllite, on granitic, and you can see the same kind of pattern where the saprolite in the below the BT is relatively coarse, low clay size fraction, high sand and silt, and yet you can see despite the mixture of mineralogies, we have the same pattern, coarse over fine over coarse. So thanks very much, all you dear colleagues. I went over. And I promised Ron it was a 25-minute talk.
So. Are there any questions before we leave?
Yeah. So do you have, I'm sure you do, solution chemistry and that protein variety?
talk to the guy who just left next to you. Aaron and I are working on solutions that we've collected over the years down to 6 meters. And yes, that which includes silica and aluminum. And yeah, we're trying to piece together whether it's a physical or a chemical story there, the upper saprolite, lower B horizon, where all these sand and silt particles are somehow reconstituting themselves as fine clay fraction. Amazing. It's not only a story of alluvial, at least hypothetically.
Yeah. If you want to help with that, I welcome you in.
All right, let's give a big thank you to all of our speakers today. And I encourage a reminder to everyone who's here that